You are listening to the Hirschsprung's Hour on UK Health Radio, where I interview incredible people with a connection to Hirschsprung's disease and other associated conditions, such as IBD, IBS, Crohn's, colitis, and ulcerative colitis. Each week, I bring you a new and exciting interview with people from all walks of life, including charity founders, models, and professional sports people. We go through the ups and downs of having Hirschsprung's, with a positive message throughout.
Hello and welcome to episode 50 of Tom's Hirschsprung's podcast. I have a very exciting one for you today, something a little bit different. With me today is a paediatric surgical nurse specialist at Southampton's Children's Hospital. And I have with me today Karen Dick. Karen, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for coming on. As we said, something a little bit different. You are very much involved in Hirschsprung's as a mother and also as a paediatric surgical nurse specialist. If we start with the latter first, in terms of becoming a nurse, why did you want to start becoming a nurse?
Well, I think, and I talked to my parents about this, when I was little, I injured my back. I fell out of a bedroom window, as you do. And broke my back and spent a period of time, probably about 3 or 4 weeks, in traction in hospital. My parents often talk about the fact that I talked about being a nurse at that time. My granddad was also a diabetic and I used to help him give him his injections when I was little. So a combination of that and also my parents always talked about the fact that I wanted to be a mum, which doesn't really make much money. It kind of developed really in the fact that I just enjoy caring for people, so it's kind of started from there.
That's fantastic. And we were talking as well offline that you have a family, or come from very much a family of teachers, so
yeah,
sort of running in the family is that caring for people, educating people. You educate people.
I try to
yourself as well. No, you definitely do. Because you're as a sort of Hirschsprung specialist, those types of people are very rare to find within the country. So you do a lot of teaching of Hirschsprung's.
Yeah.
Did you go sort of straight into working in Hirschsprung's?
No. So I started off doing my nurse training at the University of Surrey. And I, from the start, chose that I wanted to be a paediatric nurse. So I trained in what we call district general hospitals. So I worked on general children's wards, caring for kind of fairly basic conditions that you would see in any hospital as a student. When I then qualified, I did what lots of us did. I followed my husband. So he got a job down near Southampton. I then applied for every hospital in the area, and it was Southampton Children's Hospital that gave me a job. I basically turned around and said, I prefer surgery over medicine, and they put me on the surgical ward. So I spent 9 years working as a staff nurse on the surgical ward at Southampton, looking after children that have had basically a specialist general surgery. So anything from your basic everyday sort of appendicitis, ingrowing toenails, all sorts of things, up to then we would obviously have children that would have surgery for Hirschsprung's and other complex bowel related conditions, children that would have stomas and so on and so forth. About 9 years in, having had 2 years off for good behavior to have my children, this job as the surgical nurse specialist came up, and I applied and got the job.
That's fantastic. Brilliant.
And I'm still here 15 years on.
Yeah, so you have plenty of experience when it comes to children's wards.
Yeah,
So in terms of Hirschsprung's itself, what has changed over the years? Because as we've said, you've got lots of experience when it comes to Hirschsprung's.
Yeah,
and I imagine, I mean, I've talked to plenty of people who have told me lots of things that have changed since I was in, but that was 32 years ago.
Yeah.
So I imagine in the last 15 years, it has changed quite a bit.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, obviously, when I originally started kind of at Southampton, so in 2000, essentially, a higher proportion of our children would basically, when they were born, would stay in hospital until they had their surgery. So certainly the way we used to manage it at Southampton is if the child was managing on washouts, they would stay in hospital, the nurses would do the washouts, and then they'd get their surgery, or they'd get a stoma, and they would then go home with their stoma and then come back at a later date and have their surgery. Now, what we do is we get children out of hospital very, very quickly. We teach parents to do washouts. So parents go home doing washouts once or twice a day, depending on what's required. And then the child comes back at older age, so at 6 months, and has their pull through when they're older. Part of that is COVID as well. So that delayed slightly how quickly we can get children in to have their pull throughs. But absolutely, the major thing was being able to teach parents how to do washouts at home, which is the big thing that's changed. And I think just also the way that surgery's done. So obviously, again, when I first started, it was a big laparotomy, so a big abdominal scar that the child would have in order to have this surgery done. And now we're doing keyhole-assisted transanal, so through the bottom, so they don't end up with massive scars at all.
Wow, that is interesting, because that's something certainly that I've seen and heard from people, that the scarring is something that has really, really changed. I mean, if anyone was to see my stomach, it is ripped to shreds. It is scarred all over the place.
Yeah.
I don't mean ripped as in muscular, unfortunately.
No.
I mean ripped as in just torn apart.
I remember when I started, one of our surgeons used to do what we would call a hockey stick. So instead of it being a straight line, they would have an L-shaped scar. That's how they would do the surgery. But yeah, it's, I mean, obviously some of our children still end up having big abdominal scars, but we try and avoid it if we can.
It's interesting. I mean, one thing that I've always called, I guess, is a big scar that goes sort of across the middle for the pull through.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, it's always been the train track. I don't know if you have another proper name for it, but for me, I've always called it a train track. What it looks like.
It does, yeah. With the little stitches either side. It's not, it's different people call them different things. Most of our kids talk about their shark bites, where their stomas have been, because they kind of have that sort of slightly puckered round shape. But yeah, it's lots of different scars. But yeah, there were more and more of our kids now have three tiny 1 centimeter scars across their abdomen, and that's it. That's all you see.
Wow. I mean, that's really interesting, just from kind of a, I guess, physical point of view. That's incredibly interesting how that's progressed over the years. Obviously, do you think that in time there will always be a scar of some kind, or will science get to the point where there will just be no visible scars whatsoever?
I think, if you talk to the people that are doing tissue transplants and all sorts, there won't be any scars at all eventually, because we'll inject some sort of nerve cell into something and it will grow and migrate, and there'll be no scars because we won't have to remove the bit of bowel that's affected. But that's a long way in the future. So there will always be some sort of scar, I think, while you've obviously got to remove some sort of bowel, whether those scars are visible or whether they're, so when we have children that literally only have it done through their bottom, so transanally, you can't see the scar because it's inside.
Okay, so it might just be a case of just internal rather than external.
Yeah.
Okay, that's interesting. I mean, I think, again, going back to sort of 30 years ago, I don't think they'd ever seen that it would have gone from that sort of big train track or big scars or whatever to, as you've described now, and as I've seen with various people who've shared their scars, just sort of very tiny scars. Yeah. So it's amazing the progress that's been made.
Absolutely.
In the last sort of, well, 2-3 decades.
Yeah.
Which is fantastic.
Yeah.
Something else that we were going to discuss as well is that you're not just a very talented pediatric surgical nurse. You are also a founding member, part of the Hirschsprung's Family Connections group, Facebook.
Yeah.
Would you like to talk a little bit about sort of how and why that started?
Yeah. So essentially, as I was kind of starting this role and really kind of learning more and more about supporting families with Hirschsprungs. So I think it is all about supporting the family. So although the child is the person that's got the condition, I think it's, to be honest, it's the parents that live it. Because if you talk to most adults who have got Hirschsprungs, they don't really remember their time in hospital as a baby. Obviously, if their time in hospital gets longer and they end up having stomas and multiple other complications, they do. But for a lot of our families these days, it is the child. It's they're kind of, by the time they're old enough to remember, they're no longer having to come to hospital. So it was comments from parents going, well, we've talked to our family and friends and no one's ever heard of Hirschsprungs, and we have to go through the whole, why is your child not toilet trained at three? Why is your child still in nappies at school? Why is this happening? Why is that happening? And you try and talk to these people and they have no idea. So I started thinking, well, hang on a second. I know there are three families in Portsmouth that don't actually live that far apart from each other. And obviously I can't hand out their names to each other without asking for consent and all this sort of thing. So I started talking to these families each individually saying, would it be useful to have? And obviously Facebook became more of a thing. And so we started basically just creating a closed Facebook group to just kind of connect families together. We were very keen that that was a positive group. So as in not just sharing all the horror stories of being in hospital, which obviously support groups can end up being, but it's also about sharing the kind of the positive stories. And once that started and we started having kind of this group, we suddenly realized that actually, because of Southampton and where it covers, so we cover the whole of the South Central, and that includes the Channel Islands. So we have a couple of patients who live on in Guernsey and Jersey, who are potentially the only patients' children at the time that live on the Channel Islands. So we started trying to organise get-togethers, informal get-togethers, when this, because if you live on the Channel Islands pay for you to fly to Southampton to come for your clinic appointments. But so these families would get a very early flight in the morning or the day before, and then spend 24 hours in Southampton before flying home the next day or something along those lines. So we would try and organise and coordinate getting parents together to meet so that they could kind of meet other people and other children with Hirschsprungs. And it just started off very informally. We have fairly kind of a few country parks around Southampton where you can kind of get together. And so we decided to hire one of their fields and just kind of get everyone together and hire a bouncy castle. And it started off small. And then various people started saying that, well, we've actually got a little pot of money from this person over here that we want to give you. And then this uncle said, actually, I'd like to run a marathon and give you the money that I raise and all this sort of thing. So slowly we started getting people wanting to give us money. So we decided that we ought to put it in a pot and do something with it. So we basically, myself and three parents who were initially the people that I kind of joined together, two of them are connected in the neonatal unit when their kids were in together at the same time and realized they didn't live that far apart from each other, both with Hirschsprungs, which was very bizarre at the time. We just kind of decided that we would pull this together and came up with some aims, which is to get people together, support families that are in hospital with Hirschsprungs in Southampton, but kind of keep it local, because people that have listened to this may realize that if you're treated in Southampton, the way we look after patients is slightly different from the way you'll be treated at a different specialist center, because there is no hard and fast rules of how you care for a child with Hirschsprungs. So everywhere does it differently. So if you go on a national support group, you will get people going, oh, we never do that, but we do this. So yeah, and that's where it came from, to try and help and support basically the families.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good. UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
I think I think that's a really interesting point you make when you talk about national groups or international groups. I've had a wonderful woman called Melissa Jones on, and she runs the UK Hirschsprungs group. And there's so many differing opinions and advice. I always, especially with this podcast and anything I post on Facebook or Instagram, I always try and steer away from advice because my experience is going to be different to other people's experience. Yeah. And also, I'm not a doctor or a nurse. So yeah. I don't want to start saying, you need to do this or you need to do that. But unfortunately, I do see quite a few people who say, well, what about doing this? And you should do that and you should do this.
So, absolutely. When we started the support group, I think a lot of support groups struggle because it tends to be a parent that starts it. But we made a point of myself and I now have colleagues, which is very exciting because I didn't when I first started. We have made a point of having our own work-based Facebook profile so that we can be in those support groups. So basically, if parents do reach out to other members and go, what should I do? The default answer is you need to contact Karen Jo Roeder, which is like our Facebook tag. They're just constantly sending them back to us. And if we don't spot it, it means those families give us a call because they're being told by everyone else that they've got to call us. So, yeah.
That's brilliant. That's brilliant that they then effectively refer to the specialists, which kind of should happen anyway. And I know you mentioned about there being national groups. There's also another one I'm part of, which is international. I mean, it's got about 10,000 people on Facebook. I don't know whether you're part of that one as well.
I try to avoid it.
They
otherwise they kind of you get a bit overwhelmed with information.
You do. I mean, for me, it's great for getting guests. Yeah, I'll be honest. So I think I'm part of every group that I can possibly be part of. And it's also interesting just to hear other people's stories. But I think that has about 10,000 maybe just over members on it, and you do see everything and anything. Mm. And I really like one of the points you made there, where it wasn't going to be horror stories or constant doom and gloom, because that's very much my principle on here.
Yeah,
you know, it's about ups and downs. Obviously, you know, you're not going to just talk wholly positively the whole time, but it is about trying to not, you know, scare people off, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, I think our parents seem to have got, so we have the kind of the two groups. So we have our support group, which is still a closed group and parents have to request to join, and then we have our kind of our charity page, which is obviously open to everybody to kind of be nosy about, and we're hoping to develop a bit more, but the closed group, we are very much about trying to help each other out and it being positive and encouraging people to say, look, we've had a small win, we've had X child has had not been in pads for 3 days and hasn't had an accident. It's those little things, and also we've got some teenagers now that have gone up through the group and some adults that are in the group going, well, actually, yeah, we were there and look at us now, we're now playing. I mean, I've got one of my patients, a couple of them playing county level rugby for their girls team and this sort of thing with a stoma, so it's still kind of they're there in the background. So when you get a parent going, my child will never be able to do this doom and gloom, they go, well, actually, hang on a second. And it's great because they don't, because much as I can say it, I can say till the cows come home, this won't stop your child from doing anything. It's I'm not talking from own personal experience, whereupon these other patients, other people in the group are. So
that's an excellent point. And it's one of the sort of many reasons why I wanted you on as well, because we come from the same sort of thought process. You know, the whole reason around this podcast was to find people that, you know, potentially have Hirschsprungs that have gone on and done, you know, amazing things.
Yeah.
I mean, I was having a look at it actually yesterday at sort of the list of guests that now we're in episode 50. We've been going, you know, a reasonable while and sort of look back and see, you know, who I've managed to talk to, and the list of professions and achievements and so many things that, yes, I mean, Hirschsprungs will have its challenges, and we're not saying it doesn't. We're not saying that you're going to have the surgery and everything will just be perfectly fine.
I'd love to be able to say that, but no.
And for some, it kind of does. You know, that for some people I've spoken to, they have the surgery and then no more surgeries after that and everything's fine. But we're not necessarily saying that that's going to happen. But what we are saying is that there are people out there who have gone through very similar things to you, and as in terms of Hirschsprung's parents, and have gone on to do incredible things. It's not a, you now have Hirschsprung, so these and these doors are closed to you.
Yeah.
Far from it.
Yeah, absolutely.
But I think that's a really, really important, really, really important message.
Yeah.
And I'm really glad you share that.
Yeah, I mean, essentially, I think myself and my colleagues would probably feel that's a large proportion of why we do the job. So I think we talk about the fact that prior to us being in post, the ward would see a lot of children coming in unwell with Hirschsprung's and all this sort of thing. I think what we see our role as is to enable parents to look after their child and spot when their things are going wrong, and being able to say, hang on a second, you know how to manage this. You just need to do X, Y, and Z and your child will be fine. And we are seeing far less patients in hospital because we're teaching our parents to be able to manage their child and their condition, which for years and years gone by didn't happen. It was they'd end up in hospital and the nurses would do it and then they'd go on their way again.
Oh, that's fantastic. And it comes from, I imagine that comes from giving confidence.
Yeah.
And yeah. That kind of, because again, if anybody's unsure, especially with health, the first person they're going to turn to is you. And the first place they're going to turn to is, yeah. if you're unsure, or if you haven't seen something, or if you haven't got the confidence, the first person they'll come to is you. So the fact that you then give them the confidence to go, oh, I've seen this before.
Yeah.
Karen's told me I need to do X, so I'll do X.
We get the whole, I've got one patient, bless him, he, whenever he feels unwell, the first thing he'll say to his mum is, don't phone Karen because she'll tell you to give me a suppository. And she goes, mum goes, I know when he's really sick because he'll tell me to call you.
Right.
But it's not that she doesn't know to do it. She just, giving me a call gives her that okay in her head to say, yes, I can do this. Rather than, I think what would have happened historically is that they'd keep them at home waiting for ages. They wouldn't want to make an appointment with their GP because their GP has less of an idea about Hirschsprung's. And so they keep them at home until it's too late and then they become unwell. Whereupon, I think because we have given our families so many ways to contact us, which I don't think is the norm, but so our families can get hold of us via WhatsApp, Facebook, Messenger, email, phone, text, whatever sort of social media way that they want to use. I haven't quite stretched to Instagram yet, but there are so many ways that it's just easy. I mean, we have families who never have credit on their phone, can't access email. The only way they talk to us is via Facebook Messenger, unfortunately, our trust is not always keen about that, but that's kind of it. If it means they contact me, they contact me. It's easy for them to get hold of me. It's not a bother, and they know that, so therefore they do it early.
Right. No, that makes absolute sense. And I get the whole not being keen about the Facebook Messenger. I like the sort of GDPR and what have you.
We're constantly saying to people, you have to understand that I cannot ensure the security of these messages. So, and then that's my kind of trust lets me get away with that because it's then family's responsibility to accept that I have no way of securing these messages. But
no, and it's quite ironic actually. I Facebook Messenger, I think, so sorry about that.
Yeah, no, it's fine. It's absolutely fine. It's normal. I'm very used to it.
But yeah, so it's, but that's fantastic that there's so many options, because, you know, sometimes, especially with not necessarily charities, but a lot of businesses, they have one phone number.
Yeah.
And, you know, you try and then you're on hold for however long. I mean, take GP surgeries, for example. You know, you have one phone number, you're on hold, you phone at whatever time they open, suddenly number 45 in the queue. Yeah. And it takes forever.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, our phone is basically surgically glued to one of the three of us every day, Monday to Friday. But yeah, it's it's always there. So
fantastic. And just a little bit more on the group itself.
Yes.
When, in terms of what year was it formed?
Oh, now you're asking a question. So hang on, let me think about this one. My patients are now about, so it's probably about 10 years ago, I think. I'm sure my parents will be shouting and screaming at me going, no, it was earlier than that. 10 or 11 years ago, something along those lines.
Fantastic. And roughly sort of, do people sort of come into the group and then leave it again, or do they sort of come in?
No, they tend to come in and just stay put. Right. So essentially, I work quite closely with, so at Southampton, we have neonatal surgical nurse specialists. Who are the people that our patients meet. So they do the same thing as I do, but with our neonatal patients, which obviously when the majority of children with Hirschsprungs are diagnosed, essentially when they meet them and a child's diagnosed, it's one of the part of the conversations they have is that we have a support group for Hirschsprungs and this is how you get onto it. We discuss it with them and they get added at kind of fairly early on. We then kind of introduce them to the group and say, have a nosy when you're ready, introduce yourself and say roughly what area of the country or you're in. And then we tend to get people bombard them with, hello, we're from here if you want to meet up at any point. I'm aware that through the group, through the charity, there are smaller little pockets of people that meet up separately and have coffee and catch up with each other when they've got children of similar ages. But generally, our families, once they're in, don't tend to leave. They just filter up through the system. I have people that I've looked after when they were tiny that are now in their 20s that I no longer look after, but are still on the group and will contact me and go, how do I now get some help? And you're like, okay. So, yeah. But it's a great group and they're just like to support each other and help each other out, so it works really well.
That's fantastic. And I think you make a really excellent point there, because when people go up through hospital and they're, you know, anything like me, you know, you're in and out every 2-3 months, and then I think it became every 6 months or whatever. Yeah. And then at 16 stops. You know, at 16,
we go to 18, but yeah.
Right. Yeah. Well, for me, it was 16 at Gosh, you know, that was that. And then it's like, I mean, fortunately enough, I was perfectly healthy enough. Mm. But it was like, right, 16, stop.
Yeah.
I'm sure if there ever was an issue, I could have called Gosh and whatever. Yes. But I think that's where the bridging of the gap really, really helps in the support groups.
Yeah, absolutely. And we are, I mean, the new buzzword at the moment is transition and how you transition people into the adult world. The adult world is a big and scary place in healthcare. And I think a lot of our families, more so in more complicated patients, really struggle when they get there. I mean, the advantage with Hirschsprungs, if you can call it an advantage, is that by the time you get to being an adult and you're kind of in that 16 to 18 category, you have kind of sussed your own body out and worked out what your triggers are and this sort of thing and work out how to manage it and are more willing. So our difficulty with your 5-year-olds is that they're not willing to sit on the toilet for 10 minutes twice a day, or they're not willing to take the medicine that they've taken every night that takes like tree bark. So this sort of thing, and it's a battle whereupon when you get to being an adult, you kind of have got it. So most of our patients are very capable, and it's all about giving them the tools and the sort of understanding to know that if these symptoms are flagging, this is what they do about it. Some of our patients, we are now beginning to transition, and we found a friendly adult surgeon who during her training spent 6 months working with us in pediatric surgery, so she's got an understanding of Hirschsprungs. She is now seeing them and kind of keeping them on the books, so if there's a problem they can contact her team and she will then see them. But it's that she sees them once or a couple of times with us, and then basically sees them once in adults on their own, and then puts them on a kind of patient-initiated follow-up. So if there's a problem, they can call her team and they will get seen. So we're beginning to, certainly in our area, trying to develop, and every area that manages children with Hirschsprung's is slowly looking at how to do that best. Because in adults, it tends to be medics that look after them, not surgeons, because actually they don't need more surgery. They just need gut management and this sort of thing. But it is interesting in the fact that I will have teenage patients who has a parent that's got Hirschsprung's, and they'll come into clinic and they'll all of a sudden go, actually, would that work for me as well? And you're like, yeah. So we use kind of antibiotics for bacterial overgrowth. And also these parents will go, oh, I wonder if that would work. And I was like, it's worth a try. So then they have to persuade their GP to do that. But yeah, so it is always an interesting one when you've got families with Hirschsprung's, parents going, oh, they never did that for me. And you're like, oh, okay, well, yeah.
But it goes back to what we said before about how there are hospitals that do things slightly differently. So you didn't want to sort of take people in the group from, you know, London or Manchester or whatever, because it would possibly lead to a little bit of confusion.
Yeah, we have an interesting situation at the moment where a family, we've got two daughters, and currently they're being treated in two separate specialist centres because of geographics of where they lived at the time. So we're currently trying to sort out which child comes which way, because mum is struggling having two teams telling her different things. So we are trying to sort out how best to manage that, because there is no, as we've said, there is no kind of hard and fast correct way to treat Hirschsprung's, because the bit about Hirschsprung's we don't understand is, although you've removed the bit of bowel that is officially aganglionic, so it's got the no nerve cells, the rest of the gut, which under a microscope looks normal, doesn't behave normally. And so there is no, I think, hard and fast rule. And you can line two people up that have exactly the same amount of Hirschsprung's that's been removed, and one of them will do absolutely fine, need no medication, no laxatives, no nothing. And you'll get another one that's on gallons of laxatives or things to slow their gut down, because they're just so different.
That is true. That's very true. I mean, anybody who's listened to any of the episodes of these podcasts will know that I've interviewed a lot of people with short segment, with it being sort of the most common Hirschsprung's. It's naturally going to find more people with short segment. But I've had 10 surgeries, but I've had people who've had maybe one or two, and I've had somebody who's had 149.
Yeah.
So it does completely differ. Yeah. So I think you're absolutely right in that sense.
Yeah. And the problem is with Hirschsprung's, if there was a hard and fast correct way, we wouldn't have three different types of surgery to fix it. So there are three common different types of surgery that we do the surgeons do when they remove the bit of bowel. If there was one perfect way of doing it, the other two would fall by the wayside. But you could line 12, and it regularly happens at our meetings, you could line 12 colorectal surgeons up, pediatric surgeons, and they would basically, a third of them would do each of the types of the operations, because it's what they prefer to do, because there's no best operation.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good. The station that makes you feel good.
So with the three different types of surgery, obviously people listening to this may have had, well, will have certainly had one of these three types.
Yep.
Would you like to just explain a little bit about what the three different types are?
Yeah, so essentially there are three that were all developed by different surgeons a long time ago. So there's the Duhamel, the Swenson, and the Suave. For a long time, I think the Duhamel was one that was done most. I find it the hardest in some ways to explain, but essentially having removed the segment of bowel that has no ganglion cells, they leave a long 4 or 5 centimetre bit of bowel that does have no ganglion cells on, but when they pull through the healthy bowel, so you have to wave my hands around to kind of describe it while I'm doing it. They pull the healthy section of bowel down behind it, and then connect them internally and kind of create almost like a bit of a pouch. So the front of that's got no ganglion cells, but the back of it does. So that essentially it allows people to squeeze out the poo and detect when there's poo there. But because they've lost some of their large bowel, it helps store it. Because when we remove the Hirschsprung's bowel, you lose kind of the rectum, which is your storage, which is where you store poo so that you can not go to the toilet all the time. So the Duhamel's basically, creates this sort of pouch. But it tends to lead to people being go less frequently. They are more on the side of constipation. You then have what's called the Swenson, which is, I think, the easiest, which is where they basically go in and they do this generally through the bottom. They will remove all of the aganglionic bowel bar about the last centimeter, because if you remove that bit, you lose your sphincters. So you have to have those so you can have control. And then they basically bring the new healthy bowel down with nerves and plumb it on top. So it's just literally plumb the two of them together. The risks with that one is that if you cut too low and remove too much of the bowel and don't leave enough, you can damage the sphincters and your ability to tell the difference between liquid, gas, and solid. So there's kind of that risk. The third type is, again, slightly more complicated. Essentially, you have a segment of aganglionic bowel, where they have the muscle, which is on the outside of the lumen of the bowel, and they remove the kind of the mucosa, the inner lining of the bowel, and pull the healthy bowel down through that center of that cuff of muscle. So again, you've got a kind of a cuff on the outside of the healthy bowel, which acts as a bit of a break, so to slow the stool down. And then you've got ganglionic bowel in the middle that can squeeze to help push poo out. The side effect of that one is the fact that you've got a cuff of muscle that can roll down a bit like a roll of a sock, if you roll a sock down your ankle. And that kind of cuff can then act as a bit of a tightening and a kind of a narrow point, which prevents people from being able to poo properly, and they can leak. So they all have their problems, and therefore no one is the perfect operation. So every surgeon that will choose which one they want to do will go, well, the reason I do this is because of X, and they will list the benefits. Those of us that are nurses that look after the kids go, it doesn't really matter what surgery you do. It's the kind of the care afterwards and the nursing looking after them and how that's managed that actually makes their outcomes better. The surgeons are beginning to accept that that is the truth. But yeah, for a long time, it was all about surgery.
Yeah. And I guess from some surgeons I've spoken to, it tends to depend on what they are more comfortable doing.
Absolutely. Yeah.
I don't know whether you found that in the same as me, where the surgeons have a preferred method. So if a child comes to them with Hirschsprung's, they will do the whatever.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So yeah. So when I started, our two surgeons that did Hirschsprung's both did Duhamel's, because that's what they did. That's what they've been trained to do. So our newer consultants that we have now, that I say they're new to me, but they've been around for about 10 or 11 years plus. No, longer than that. They would have trained doing the Duhamel, but have decided they want to learn to do the other versions, and have got kind of, so they've shared. So they've asked surgeons that have trained in America who have done the Swenson Suave to come over, and who've done some time there during their training. They've come down and helped train. So they've learned from other surgeons, not from our center. So they've come down and then done it together. And then whenever we do a pull through, there is generally at least two consultant surgeons in the theater at the same time, because they need that experience because of the infrequency, the rarity of Hirschsprung's. You want two experts doing it, not two junior people. So, and that's certainly the way our surgeons keep their experience and their hand in, is because they do it together and they do it sort of thing. So each of the surgeries are done with a couple of consultants.
Yeah. That makes absolute sense, because it is, as you said, it is very rare. And it's, we mentioned several times on the show, 1 in 5,000. You know, it's not a surgery you'll be doing every day.
No, I mean, I think, so, I mean, we, as I say, in Southampton, we cover the whole of the kind of south central of the country. So kind of South London, not Southampton, but below London, across to kind of Dorset and to West Sussex and obviously into the Channel Islands. So we've got a lot of children in that area. I don't know the full demographics, but essentially we will get anywhere between 8 and 12 patients with Hirschsprung's a year that we manage roughly in our area. And that's similar to a lot of the centres. So that's kind of a sort of a standard sort of number that you would get. So although I call myself a specialist of, well, I don't call myself a specialist, but I am.
You are. Yes, we, you are. I do.
Children under 18, I've got about 100, 120 children that I currently look after that are kind of from birth to 18, because that's roughly the number that kind of, as they grow up, and they obviously drop off at the top end as we get more in at the bottom end. And we will have years where we have less. So this year, bizarrely, we've only had about 4 children this year so far, whereupon I think the year before and the year before that we had 12. Okay. So it's different from different times. So yeah.
Absolutely. No, that's fantastic. And that is very much in terms of the numbers that I've heard from other hospitals as well, that sort of 12 to 14.
Yeah.
One a month, essentially.
Roughly, yeah. Come in clusters. It's like buses.
Yeah, well, yeah, it's like we were talking before about genetics, weren't we?
Yes.
Twins that are born, potentially. Yeah. One with Hirschsprung's, one without.
One without. Yeah.
So, yeah, it very, very much like London buses.
Yes.
Just as we sort of circle around to the end, and bring it back to the charity itself.
Yeah.
You've mentioned a lot of things about organising trips and how people support, etc. Just where would you like to see the charity head towards? Obviously, COVID has been, a very, very difficult time for every organization, and especially charities being hard hit. But where would you like to see, what direction would you like to see it go?
I mean, essentially what we want, or what I would love, is to be able to say that we have 2 events a year that we meet up, that we provide grants. So we give grants to family to support transport to and from hospital if they're having multiple appointments. And just that's it, really, essentially kind of making connections between families who have Hirschsprung's. And so, either face-to-face or kind of, and just encouraging patients to meet with other people, and just really getting out into the kind of communities around these people a bit more about what Hirschsprung's is, and the fact that not every child that goes to school will be toilet trained, because of a condition that no one can see or ever heard about. And that kind of constant trying to have to explain to people that the child that's in your class as a teacher that's constantly having to ask to go to the loo is not because they're misbehaving, it's because they've had half their colon chopped out. And actually, they have to go 8 times a day, and that's their norm. So it's kind of trying to explain that it's one of those, it's a buzzword, isn't it? Hidden disability. But it's trying to kind of get that out there that, this is not a condition that everyone's heard of.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think we're very much aligned on that. Very much aligned on getting info out there.
Yes.
Which I think is so and educating. I think that's really, really important. And just very lastly, where can people find the charity or donate if they want to?
So the best way now is probably through Facebook. So there is the charity page, which is Hirschsprung's Family Connections Charity. There is a QR code on that page that means you can scan and donate through PayPal to the bank account. And I mean, we have historically had a website, but unfortunately that's a capacity level I do not have to continue. But certainly, the information will be via Facebook on the charity page.
Brilliant. Fantastic. Well, Karen, thank you so much for joining me. And also thank you so much for all of the work that you do for people with Hirschsprung's.
That's all right. Thank you.
Invaluable. So thank you so much.
No problem.
You are listening to the Hirschsprungs Hour on UK Health Radio, where I interview incredible people with a connection to Hirschsprungs disease and other associated conditions, such as IBD, IBS, Crohn's, colitis, and ulcerative colitis. Each week, I bring you a new and exciting interview with people from all walks of life, including charity founders, models, and professional sports people. We go through the ups and downs of having Hirschsprungs with a positive message throughout.